Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We might go a little past your imagination today, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Today, we're coming to you live from the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington. Wanted to let you know that the solar wind was a pretty brisk 371.6 kilometers per second. The one thing that people are really noticing right now is little sunspot 963 is actually acting up a little bit. The sunspot's two dark cores are each larger than Earth, and they are connected by an unstable magnetic field that crackles with C-class solar flares. Normally we see A-class, and it can get as bad as M-class or X-class, but a C-class that can cause a lot of problems with satellite TV and cell phones and pagers and things like that. The eruptions have been entertaining onlookers with solar telescopes. I highly recommend picking up a coronoscope if you're interested in actually looking at the sun. If you've never seen the sun live through a Coronado telescope, it's an excellent thing to look through. We're going to be going out on the grounds. The first interview is going to be with Joel Garvin. He is the director of the New Energy Movement, and we'll bring him to you here in just a couple of minutes as soon as I walk out here under this beautiful shade tree in Trout Lake, Washington. I also wanted to let you know about one of our new affiliates. Our sponsor is OvernightPrints.com. If you get business cards or brochures or letterhead or postcards, that is the place to go. OvernightPrints.com, as cheap as $9.95 overnight. You can get business cards and also postcards and brochures and even letterhead and envelopes. Well, here we are at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. Many great speakers have been here. We're going to have several of them with us tonight on X Squared Radio. Our first one is Joel Garvin, that's what I thought, and he is the man that I normally see out on the circuit representing the New Energy Movement, and he's going to tell you a little bit about himself, what he spoke about for about 10 or 15 minutes, and let him tell you about clean new energy ideas that are floating out there. Normally you would think that these ideas would come from Exxon or from one of the big oil companies or one of the power companies or one of the big universities, but that turns out not to be the case. Most of the great ideas are coming out of basements and attics and garages of engineers that have been working in the industry all their lives, and they pour their heart and souls into their inventions, and then they look for a way to get their idea out and try to find funding and try to find expert help in vetting their idea and getting their problems solved. And that's what the New Energy Movement does. They're all about awareness. And we'll get Joel to tell you a little bit about that. Here he is.
Well, thanks, Brooks. You know, as I've observed over the years, as far as discussions about new energy mostly have come through organizations that were very focused on the technology aspects. And they would be hosting conferences that were appealing mostly to the physics community, the electrical engineers, the hard scientists, and that's who made up the audience. And probably for about a decade, there was really no forum where the new energy concepts and ideas could be transmitted to the public at large, where you didn't need to be a PhD to really grok what was really going on here. So New Energy Movement came about as a way to fill that gap where the public could get engaged directly to learn and understand about the need to support the funding of new technologies for energy in a very substantial and serious way. I think anyone who looks about our planet and considers the big picture here as far as the problems, whether it's environmental deterioration or climate change, geopolitical issues, socioeconomic problems, you know, would have to say that, look, we've got a clock that's ticking, and we have to make some changes. And energy is central to so many of the things that we do. And that's where we're going to be focusing.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, a lot of people we hear on the news say, you know, an electric car just won't sell. The people just wouldn't buy one. So that's why General Motors isn't going to build one. And then we see the Toyota Prius come out, and although it runs on gasoline, it seems to get better mileage than most gasoline cars, but it is pretty bloody expensive. I mean, people have to buy an expensive car, then 5 years later they have to buy an expensive battery. Isn't there better technology out there? Don't you think there really is a public demand for this technology? What's holding it back?
Well, undoubtedly there's a demand. I think anyone who thinks about, you know, what's happened to the average fuel economy since the 1970s, and when you examine it, really not much. There hasn't really been any change. And that flies totally in the face of what we've seen in improvements in efficiency and technology upgrade and all the other common areas that we're familiar with telecommunications, computing, medical diagnostics, pharmaceutical drugs. All of these areas have seen tremendous advances, and yet we're still, you know, getting 20-something miles per gallon if you're buying a mid-sized car, and still in the teens if you're buying any type of utility vehicle or truck. And it's pretty pathetic. And I think the public intuitively knows that we can do better, but for some reason we're not. And I think that our citizens are wise to the fact that this has been a manipulated market. And there has been clearly some type of cartel. Is that too strong a word?
No, I don't think so.
and that would embrace automotive and the energy infrastructures.
Well, you know, I worked in the automotive industry for a long time, and we always have these cost-cutting meetings. Oh, we need to lower the cost of the headliners 10%, or we need to lower the cost of the brake material by 5% this year. And really, all those problems could be solved if sales were better. So it's always baffled me as to why the automotive industry couldn't sit down and say, gee, do you think there's a market for a three-quarter ton pickup that gets 70 miles per gallon? Do you think there's a market for an electric family van that you could drive for 4 or 5 hours a day, take it home, plug it in, and not use any fuel at all? What happened to the technology that we are sure is out there? What happened to it?
Well, I could tell you that even using broken English, I could sell a 70-mile per gallon pickup and make a hell of a living off of that. Well, where's the technology gone? I mean, if you follow what's happened with the electric car, which had a quite a strong following and was a not just a novel concept, but also a very practical concept, and had a lot of passionate supporters of the electric car, and the first one being the GM EV1.
Now they were all sold, right?
Yes, Yeah, they were buying them, and it had a market and a growing market, and then next thing you know, they're pulled off the market. And that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, details what happened in that saga, and it didn't make a lot of sense for that to be pulled off of the market. But it does speak to the fact that there's some manipulation going on. So how do we break through this? How do we take technologies of promise around the vested interests that keep a lid on having these real breakthroughs? I think that it needs to come from the public at large. There needs to be an upswelling of a demand that things change. The technologies are real, they're available, but they need to make it into the public domain. And anyone who has a chance to take a look at some of the interesting movies that appear on Google or YouTube in the way of new energy technologies, could Google something like water fuel or water car and come across a number of videos that show really neat concepts for splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen and using those components directly as fuel or as for hydrogen boosting to extend the efficiency of current hydrocarbon fuels.
So what does the general public do? What does John Q. public, who's getting ready to buy a car or is getting ready to build a house, where do they go to find this technology? Where is it for sale?
Well, right now, there are actually very few outlets where you can find any type of technology that will take you to that quantum leap in efficiency. There are some outfits that do supply aftermarket kits for doing things like hydrogen boosting. One that comes to mind is Hydrogen Power Incorporated. People can look at that and see what their concepts are, and there's a number of others that can do that. Most of these, though, require some relatively expensive retrofits of an existing vehicle. And you know, the average American citizen being conditioned for convenience, they want to be able to buy something readily right on the market as a new vehicle or a used vehicle that already has these upgrades in it. And quite frankly, you can't find that right now. About the closest you can get to high efficiency right now is to buy a conventional hybrid like a Prius or something that will burn biodiesel, and there's but as far as something that really is a step change from the current fuel efficiency, there's really nothing that the big five are providing. And that's something that we need to change. And I think it's going to take a lot of clamoring from the public at large to make that happen. Or maybe support a new player or two or three to bring that out and introduce some real serious competition that goes about business in a whole new way.
Well, now, Joel, you've been working on a new legislative proposal that ostensibly, from what I understand, from what you presented here, I don't have the exact language, but it asks Congress to appropriate research funding to allow some of this technology to get past the drawing board phase into the prototype phase and maybe even into the hands of some of these commercial factories that can send this technology to Lowe's and Home Depot and maybe AutoZone or Advance or Napa, places where the consumer can get their hands on these things. Tell us a little bit about that legislative proposal.
Well, it's called the Energy Innovation Act of 2007. And this came about in late 2006 when one of the members of Congress had approached the leadership of New Energy Movement and asked if we could provide him some draft legislation that spoke to the need to provide serious and urgent funding support for new energy technologies. So myself and some advisors had taken a number of weeks to craft some legislation, something that none of us had done before, but we came up with something that we were very proud of, and we went and spent several weeks in front of members of Congress and their legislative staffs presenting the Energy Innovation Act of 2007. And what's really unique about it is that it segregates what qualifies as new energy. And we define it as new and unconventional approaches to energy generation. New and unconventional, as opposed to the current existing and available sources of power, which are the standard fossil fuels and nuclear and even the standard conventional renewable sources of wind, solar, biofuels. Those would not qualify for the type of funding that we're talking about with this particular bill. We're focused on unconventional sources that can be truly breakthrough in nature.
So this breakthrough in nature.
Yes, definitely. And some of the key provisions of the Act are the establishment of an Office of Energy Innovation. It'd be a new office with direct congressional oversight to make sure that it stays highly focused on its mission and doesn't get muddled up with a lot of the bureaucracy and politics that go on inside the Department of Energy. We also would have a citizen oversight council that would be an independent and publicly accountable citizen oversight that would make sure that the Office of Energy Innovation executes its mission in high integrity and purpose. So it stays focused and no monkey business goes on where vested interests can come and disrupt the mission. That other key provision would be a very substantial level of funding, and in this case, on the order of $2.25 billion per year for a minimum of 10 years to provide funding for new and unconventional energy in the way of small business innovative research grants, small business innovative research loan guarantees, and technology prizes. For instance, the most outstanding new energy prototype would qualify for perhaps a $10 million cash prize. Now, that gets people motivated. When you're willing to put cash in hand for a real development that can be demonstrated to the American public, I think people get excited about something like that in a hurry.
Well, now you're talking about competition and free enterprise, and that's what America does best. The other thing that America does best, and maybe we've lost sight of, is the actual citizen legislator. And it appears to me that the folks down at New Energy Movement and yourself have actually filled the role of a true citizen legislator by drafting legislation, not from the point of view of some fancy attorney or some bureaucrat or some corporate bigwig that's going to do something that's going to funnel billions of dollars into their own coffers for who knows what, some new home for another executive or another $50 million bonus for some retiree, but real legislation that does real work on a grassroots level. We are probably talking about a new tax, though, so how much is this actually really going to cost the average American, this bill?
Well, if you take $2.25 billion per year and divide it by our population, you come up with a per capita amount of about $8. $8 per year, Brooks, that's a couple cups of coffee at most coffee houses. And when I talk to citizens at large about this, they laugh at that cost because it's so minuscule compared to the potential benefit. And even in the case here where it's very minimal, we have provisions in this bill for there to be a revolving technology fund. And what I mean by that is any technologies that have been funded through the Energy Innovation Act that become commercially viable and profitable technologies would be required to contribute a small percentage of their profits back into a revolving technology fund that would then become the source of future grants and loan guarantees and technology prizes, with the idea to gradually wean back any amount that the taxpayer would need to provide at all. So it's meant to be a sustaining and ongoing source of funding for technology improvements over time.
Well, now that sounds fascinating, this perpetual energy fund, that once the technology that has been funded becomes successful, and I have a feeling that a 70-mile-per-gallon truck or even an electric van would be highly successful in this country, the funds, the profits generated from that would replenish the fund that originally got them funded, and so the amount of tax that went back to the American people would get smaller and smaller each year, but the innovations would get larger and larger. Don't you think this would kind of loosen the foothold of the big oil cartels, though? Do you think that there's room for this competition in the energy market?
Well, clearly there's room for it. What's lacking, though, is the political will to do this. You mentioned that that New Energy Movement truly is a citizen effort. It's a grassroots effort. We're a small nonprofit staffed by an all-volunteer leadership and volunteers right now. And, we are taking these substantive actions to educate, to help citizens feel empowered, that there are real things they can do. You know, our legislature, whether it is at the local or state level or the federal level, these folks work for us. Many of them have forgotten that, especially at the federal level. when you go into Washington, D.C., it is your privilege and right, and I would suggest your prerogative as a vigilant citizen to get in there. Yes, a civic duty, Brooks. I'm glad you mentioned that because it is a civic duty. You get in there and you go into their office and you let them know what's on your mind. High on my mind is the need to change our direction on energy policy. And so going in there and demanding that they want your vote, they got to start exercising some common sense and wisdom here and wean our country off dependence of fossil fuels, foreign oil, and any other type of energy that is not long-term sustainable, and get us onto energy that really reflects our place in history right now, which right now we're not reflecting that compared to other technology areas.
I couldn't agree with you more. What I do see is in the news a lot of political grandstanding when it comes to the subject of energy, but it usually revolves around biofuels or solar or wind and or some university grant or even NASA, or I've even heard ETs coming up with technologies. But is this really where our solution is going to come from? Is it going to come out of the universities? Is it going to come out of Caltech or MIT? Is it going to come out of NASA or General Motors? Or is it really going to come from the brilliant minds we have in this country? Is there an avenue for this to come forth?
Well, it actually could come out of any of those arenas. There's a lot of brilliant researchers working in all of these institutions, whether they're academic, federal laboratories, or corporations. Problem with those avenues, though, is that there is such a vested interest in the current energy infrastructure. If you look at the way mainstream academic science research is done, so much of the grants that are provided come either from corporate or government interests who want to maintain the status quo, more or less. They really are not funding breakthrough and disruptive technologies that could upset the current status quo of the energy infrastructure. So it in my opinion, is more likely that the breakthroughs will come from a small group, perhaps a solo inventor who's not tied to any of the big research institutions. But it's been difficult to this point in time for those solo researchers with a brilliant idea and a working prototype to take their development out into the public domain. Generally speaking, the inventors themselves have a brilliant skill and talent in their technological area. But they generally are not as versed in business, in legal, in marketing, and the other things that are required to successfully march a good technology out into the public domain.
And the folks down at New Energy Movement will connect the inventors, once this funding is in place, with those experts that can help them with the legal and with the marketing and with the manufacturing venues, so that they don't have to wear all the hats. You've got a support team of experts that are ready to help them once this funding goes into place.
Right. We look at this as a multi-pronged task that we have. One is to educate the public, educate policymakers, educate mainstream science first about the fact that there are new and breakthrough type of energy technologies that merit our support. But it's also to help the inventor community understand that there are people ready to form the tiger teams around them to marshal these technologies out into the public and commercial domain so that they see the light of day and they actually make a difference. And we also have a perspective on this from the need to affect this change globally, not just at our local level. For instance, I live in Portland, which is a pretty green community in contrast to other areas of the United States. But I'm not doing this just for Oregonians or just for Americans. This is something that we need to share planet-wide because the problems that we have are so large facing humanity right now that we need to embrace this as a whole system. And that means the technologies be shared. Once we do that, then all bets are off, and things will truly start to transform.
So you're not talking about just a U.S. market with 300 million people. You're talking about a 6.5 billion person market. One final question. What's the rush? Why can't we wait 25 or 30 or 50 years for technology to catch up with demand? Why are we doing it now?
Brooks, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of the leading voices in the climate change science areas and in the environmental science areas. And quite frankly, the picture that's painted by these experts, whose daily job is to monitor the health of the planet, is pretty gloomy. And I'm an optimist, which motivates me, and by the nature of the fact that I'm a father and soon-to-be grandfather, to make a difference here and get things moving along toward what we need to do. And I call it trying to create a tidal wave of wisdom among the ranks of citizens who need to feel empowered to do something, make a difference here. So we're trying to provide that education and awareness. Now as far as what's going on, as far as the timeline goes, you know, talking to some of the experts at NASA, for instance, in conversations with their chief technology officer at the NASA Langley facility, and also to NASA's top climatologist, James Hansen, there is a ticking clock here where they don't think we have more than, let's say, 10 years to make a real substantial change. And quite frankly, the incremental changes provided by the advancements in solar and wind power and biofuels are woefully inadequate to get us where we need to be and as fast as we need to get there. We need a quantum breakthrough, and I would suggest we need 2, 3, 4, a dozen quantum breakthroughs to add to the full portfolio that we can apply to start to lighten the human footprint on the planet, which right now is exceedingly heavy and is taking a real toll on the ecosystem of the whole sphere.
All right. Thank you very much, Joel. Joel Carbon with the New Energy Movement. He made an outstanding presentation here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. I wanted to let you know that you can always go to x2-radio.com and keep up with these subjects. We try to keep these things posted, keep the links posted there. Also, make sure to visit our affiliates. I did want to mention NitroPack. You know that that they are doing the food supplements and also the emergency preparedness items. If you want to learn more about the New Energy Movement, you can just go to newenergymovement.org. They are a nonprofit. They'll keep all this information posted there. I believe they even have a link to a site that will tell you the top 100 technologies that exist on the planet right now. That's the newenergycongress.org. And they pretty much do an independent review of inventors and their prototypes or their concepts. You can learn about those on your own, do your own reading, develop your own skepticism for it. But I've been there myself, and I can tell you after reading the top couple dozen technologies, you have to wonder why we are still shoveling our planet into our gas tanks and burning it. It doesn't make any sense. One of the most profound quotes that was in Joel's presentation was, "The Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone." All right, we're not out of oil, surely, but can I keep this card?
Yes, sir.
All right. See this card? I'll hold it up next to the phone. Okay, there you go. NewEnergyMovement.org. Joel Garvin is the president of that organization, and he was with us for the last half hour. Don't forget that you can always go to OvernightPrints.com, get action fast. If you need business cards tomorrow, that is the way to go. My next guest is my good friend Alfred Lambermont Weber. He is with the Institute for Cooperation in Space. They drafted the Peace in Space Initiative. He is also involved with the Star Dreams Corporation, a nonprofit that's designed to raise awareness on this subject. And Alfred is also an attorney. He's also a judge on the World Court. And I can tell you, we could just turn the phone over to Alfred for the next 3 hours, but we've got him for 30 minutes. So we're not going to take any phone calls today because We are on remote location at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington. Alfred was a presenter here, and his website is peaceinspace.com. We're going to let you hear about some of the actions that are being done by our government and jointly with other governments. You know there have been a lot of space launches recently. You may not know what they're all about. Some of them are research projects, but some of them are weapons projects. And that's what this program is about, public awareness. We want to let you know what some of those projects might be and maybe why we would be putting weapons in space. And I guess that'll be my first question for you, Alfred. The weapons that we're putting in space, are they to protect the United States from other nations, or are they there to protect our nation from something else in space?
Brooke, that's a key question. First of all, let me say that it's a pleasure to be talking with you again. I think that the primary reason there is to keep the war machine going and to keep on collecting the trillions of dollars in tax tax monies to keep the government monies hot off the presses, away from social needs, and toward creating useless systems. And the archetype of this, just to show you that we can prove it very, very simply, was the so-called anti-ballistic missile system, which the U.S. and Russia, two hawks, Leonid Brezhnev and Richard Nixon, outlawed it with the ABM Treaty in 1972 because it's an inherently destabilizing weapon. It's actually a weapon in aid of a nuclear first strike because it's a misnomer. It is not a defensive weapon. The military reason for an ABM system is if you launch a nuclear first strike and you destroy all of the nuclear assets of your enemy, you want the ABM system to be able to defend against what's left that comes with a counterstrike. And that's what they were designed for. So by installing a ballistic missile defense system, you are automatically setting up worldwide nuclear war.
Well, I remember the SDI, and I think I asked that question at a town hall meeting that my local congressman had. Oh, back in the early 80s, I said, don't you think this is a destabilizing weapon system? But the interesting thing about it is shortly thereafter, the Soviet Union collapsed and the threat from intercontinental ballistic missiles seemed to evaporate, and we had, pretty much a peace dividend that was due the American people. Maybe we were looking at dissolving some of the bureaucracies, and we were looking at scaling back some of the global thermonuclear community that we had going. And so a lot of people were going to be out of work, and a lot of those tax dollars were going to be trimmed out of the budget and returned to the American people as an economic stimulus package. But it appears that since then, the folks down at Wars R Us always seem to come up with a new conflict that we need some new weapon system for, and now it's, of course, the war on terror, which is pretty terrible, I think, pretty terroristic in itself. But the weapon systems and the monitoring systems that are being put in space appear to have much more power than just being able to control space for terrestrial reasons. What else do you think is going on here?
Yes, right. I think that's a key issue. And just to show you that serious people are standing up on this issue, as many of your listeners probably know, the former Minister of Defense of Canada, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, made a speech at the University of Toronto in the fall of 2005, in which he said, "I simply had to speak up because the U.S. is now placing weapons in space." Carry out an interstellar war, i.e., these weapons are being placed in space as a Maginot Line in order to, quote, defend the planet against advanced ethical extraterrestrial civilizations. Now, this was brought out in her Disclosure Project testimony by our ISIS co-director, Dr. Carol Rosen, who was a protege of Dr. Wernher von Braun, who was both the Nazi rocket scientist. He actually was a whistleblower then and tried to and organized various escape attempts during that regime. But he was a brilliant scientist who organized the U.S. Space program also. And what he told Carol was that with the collapse of communism, which I think that you just mentioned, the U.S. lost its permanent enemy. And so that's what you need to keep a war going. You have to have the Hegelian dialectic of enemies, which you control both sides of, because war is an industrial activity, and that's how you make the money on war. So he said, knowing from the inside and as a whistleblower, he said, and this was many years, 20 or so years in advance of 9/11, which was a false flag operation, and what he said was that there's going to be a false war against terror, so that we're going to have all of these rogue nations that we'll war against, and that the terrorist nations will supply the enemy, but that's going to run out, so that then we'll have a war against the asteroids, and that'll make we'll have to build all these space-based platforms, but that the final card will be, quote, a war against the evil extraterrestrials. And that seems to be what we're building up against, not only justifying the trillions to build up space-based weapons, thereby just in military, but what they call ARVs, which are alien reproduction craft. So what we'll do is we'll create both the evil ETs and we'll create the weapons, and we'll create both sides of the war in space.
So you're saying that these weapons builders, and I guess now on our planet the biggest ground weapons builders are the Pakistanis and the Americans. We make most of the weapon systems on the Earth. Unfortunately, if people aren't fighting, if peace breaks out, in other words, there's no need for weapons here on the Earth. So as that need breaks down, and certainly peoples are going to demand that eventually, you're saying that they would almost, in Steven Spielberg style, create a new enemy. And by that I mean, not only would they build the craft that look and act like alien vehicles, but we would actually stage a conflict and then use the American people's panic against that. Oh my gosh, how are we going to protect ourselves against advanced technology? Well, I guess we have to advance our military technology. More tax dollars and more designed to build that kind of infrastructure. I guess my question would be, where's the end of it? What do they hope to accomplish, or do you think that they hope to accomplish, by creating this permanent military community that seems to be tied into all of the governmental bodies of the world? What do you think that they are trying to accomplish here?
I think that's an excellent question. I think if we can go to the internet and look at their vision. Go to the internet and go to the U.S. Space Command. It's also on the website of the Federation of American Scientists. It's called Vision for 2020, put out by the U.S. Space Command. Excuse me. And their vision is to occupy the military high ground of space, and from space to rule both Earth and space. And it's a vision of a military empire which rules the solar system and beyond, and which rules every square centimeter of Earth with sensors and robots. And it's the ultimate hierarchical, I hate to say it, patriarchal fantasy.
So this is kind of like the Terminator movie, where we're talking about putting surface monitoring devices in orbit, or even in geostationary orbit, to extend the military arm almost to every street corner on the planet so that no opposition can rise to them. Well, if history has taught us nothing, it's taught us this, that absolute power corrupts absolutely. What happens when the wrong people come to power and they have at their fingertips this kind of not only planetary, but maybe even solar system control over the resources in our solar system, the movement of people, and the rise of opposing governmental views, of opposing political views? What happens in that kind of world? What is the function of exopolitics in trying to reverse that kind of trend?
Right. Hopefully, it will not even get to that, and that is that this impulse, which is really we can call it the Fourth Reich, and it's an attempt to carry the vision of fascism into outer space. I like to call it the ABC future. A for Armageddon, the world ends in fire. B for global warming, the world ends in ice. Or C, the C future, i.e. an exopolitical future, which is where the preponderant majority of Earth, 80 to 90% of the people who are enlightened, wise, and have all of the resources that we need within ourselves. We don't need a ruling elite anymore. Technology works for us. We are part of nature. And when we begin to connect up with our fellow civilizations within the Earth in extraterrestrial dimensions, that are now approaching and seeking us out in an interactive way, we really have a positive path. We really have a positive future, a see future, i.e. we can all see this positive future, and this extremely negative, cataclysmic, fascistic future will have been almost like the resistance that electricity requires to create itself to run along a wire, but that this is part of a natural process of positive human evolution.
Well, speaking of human evolution, in your opinion, do you think the human race, the race of humans on this planet at this time in the year 2007, of whichever dynasty this is of human development, assuming there may have been ancient civilizations that reached a similar zenith and then either through cataclysms or self-destruction or maybe just an exit strategy, we were left with another remnant to begin another civilization. Here we are in this year. I want to ask you, in your opinion, do you think the human race is on the verge of a societal shift in the sense that we are no longer willing to fight over a patch of ground or a glass of water, but or even a national flag, that maybe we're on the verge of cooperating as a race on this planet and join a community of possible other races on other worlds? Do you think we're on the verge of doing that?
Yes. I would say most emphatically yes. And I can even give a date to when the That's a hypothesis. I think that the date is in the year 2000, our collective shift began because the exopolitics model landed on the planet. And it, along with many other forces, it became what I like to call the banana that the 100 monkeys could wash. And what the exopolitics model says is that we live in a highly populated universe populated by diverse, intelligent civilizations living under universal law, having their own governance forms and mediated by universe politics. And we on Earth are part of this mix. And prior to that, in the 20th century, what had ruled science is what had ruled science for the past 1,000 years, and that is that all intelligent life ended at the geostationary orbit. That was the iron law. If one deviated from that, if one was a professional, you lost your teaching job, you became a disgrace, you were dismissed from your government job, you could not deviate from that one public kind of false truth. And with the advent of the exopolitics model, suddenly the human race had a place to put what it knows intuitively is the truth. And so we have in the year 2007, in rapid succession, in March of 2007, around March 12th, the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, came out and said, yep, I did see that 2-mile-wide spacecraft that went over Arizona on the night of March 13th, 1997. 2 weeks later, France came out and said, well, we're releasing our secret UFO, meaning extraterrestrial craft data. On May 2nd, the UK became the second nation. So now there's an opening, and it's part of an organic continuum, because we have a way now to understand it, and we can think these thoughts.
So now we have this public swell of almost simultaneous acknowledgement that, hey, we're not alone in the universe. And not only are we not alone in the universe, but those other races have been here. And politically, we're starting to interact with them. And we're going to compare this to the militarization of space, which you're trying to stop with the Institute for Cooperation in Space. And by the way, if you want to learn more about that, please go to peaceinspace.com and read the proposal that they are trying to get read in the General Assembly of the United Nations. And I'll let you know a little bit. We'll get Alfred to tell you a little bit more about that here in just a minute. And then maybe, possibly, how X Squared Radio and myself might be involved in getting that done. But what we've done here in the last 17 minutes is we've set the stage for either the enlightenment and metamorphosis of the human race into a galactic community, or the suppression of this information by a militaristic society that sees a clear and present danger of its role as the primary breadwinner, as it were, for the planet. So as these two forces come into opposition of one another, I guess my question is, what is the role of exopolitics in helping the average American understand his or her place in a galactic community, not just a global community, and how this really neutralizes the military position? Because in the end, it's men and women that fly those airplanes. It's men and women that drive those tanks, that punch those buttons, that make up those programs, that run those weapons in space. So two questions. Are we actually capable of militarily standing up against a UFO that might come to this planet? And do you think the world community is about ready for that to be put to an end? Those are my two questions.
Okay. Well, as to the first question, there's a great paradox here, because the reason why the U.S. and the echelon countries, kind of the Anglo-American bloc, have maintained such a bodyguard of lies around the issue of do extraterrestrials exist, is that since the late 40s and early 50s, and we know this now from whistleblowers and from direct witnesses, the U.S. has maintained top secret extraterrestrial human liaison programs. And these extraterrestrial human liaison programs, in fact, have transferred very advanced energy propulsion systems, including time travel teleportation systems. We have most recently a witness to this in Jim Sparks. In his very excellent 18 years of testimony to this, so that the reason why the U.S. military doesn't want civilians delving into extraterrestrial issues is that it has wanted to maintain its monopoly on extraterrestrial technology. And that's what we ran into in the proposed Jimmy Carter White House study in 1977. Now, what the extraterrestrials say, and those ETs that were involved in this secret program, is that that technology was released to be applied for the benefit of the planet. It was not to be applied for military purposes, whereas, in fact, it has been applied for military purposes.
So it's been a violation of trust.
Yes. And that time travel teleportation technology would make all these concrete highways obsolete, all of these vehicles, these pieces of steel that we fuel with explosions inside internal combustion engines that throw pollution into the air, which, as you said, loading in Mother Earth into the engine, is all obsolete because they're meant to move people and things through quantum processes of teleportation of advanced physics. And that is something that is inevitable for our planet, and that was transferred beneficially to our planet. So one of our proposals in Exopolitics, which we're going to be inaugurating this fall at the X Conference in Washington, D.C., September 14th to 16th, 2007, is we're going to be calling for a truth amnesty disclosure process. And that is what the ETs say and what reason says through the South Africa experience, is that, yes, there were many crimes committed by U.S. government employees over the last 60 years. But let's get a truth amnesty process going, because there are people within this sector that say it's time to release these technologies. We all need to live together. Let's have a commission. If you come up, as in South Africa, you tell the truth, this is what I did, you get amnesty, and these technologies can be released to the civilian economy in an open source way. And virtually, within a few years, the entire landscape changes. The adaptability, what we call the invisible hand, will be working overtime.
Well, that sounds like it offers a lot of hope for the world, not just in the sense that maybe we will never see tanks rolling down our street, and we're certainly never going to see an Independence Day kind of conflict between some extraterrestrial group that comes here to this planet to try to wipe us out, and we're going to try to defend ourselves against them, that there is some kind of universal law out there, that there is some agreement between worlds, that one world doesn't go conquer another world and try to consume the universe like locusts, that hopefully by the time they've reached that level of technology, they've also reached that level of wisdom and that level of maturity with their race, that they realize that you don't have to consume energy, that energy is free for the consuming, and that we don't have to hoard energy one person from another like we do in this country. We hide it behind the locked gas pumps, and you can't get to it without money, and you can't get to money without, you know, having a job, and you can't have a job without getting a government education, and, you know, it seems to create one entire self-sustaining empire of money. There doesn't seem to be a way to be independent of that. But this exopolitical view that you have of deweaponizing space and allowing ET technology to proliferate throughout the planet so that there is no difference between the haves and the have-nots as far as a clean glass of drinking water or enough electricity to be able to refrigerate your food or process your food for consumption. It does seem that there's a little immaturity in not only in our government, but maybe even in our educational system that assumes that given enough food, enough energy, enough water, that the race would proliferate and overpopulate this planet. That seems to be a popular argument these days, that we couldn't possibly give free energy to the third world because they would not only overpopulate their country, they would spill over into our country and they'd be building houses in the middle of our golf courses. So we couldn't have that. Is there a wisdom that comes along, a responsibility that comes along with the ability to access this kind of energy so that we don't overpopulate our planet, so that we do use the natural resources of our planet in a responsible and perpetual way? Is there that effort that goes along in exopolitics as well?
Yes, right. I'm very, very glad that you asked that question because that brings the views of, I think, it's time to finally put to rest Mr. Malthus, who was a greatly, I would say, overrated second-class economist of the 18th century, who the elites of the 18th century used to further certain policies at that time, which have been brought forward, and that is the policy of the limited pie, and the policy that there's only so much to go around. Once we are able to introduce these advanced propulsion systems, these advanced energy systems, zero point energy systems, quantum time travel, teleportation, energy systems, Malthusian concepts of the carrying capacity of the Earth do not apply. In fact, there have been studies that show that even now, without assuming these advanced technologies, you can have a very comfortable carrying capacity of, 10 to 15 billion per person. Once we have eliminated the permanent war economy, which has so many artificial territorial constraints to it, and we can assume rational land planning to have, very, very utopian use of land where you could have very futuristic concentrated cities that are built underground or in towers and these kind of flourishing landscapes and people teleporting their stuff from one place to the other. This isn't science fiction. This can be carried out with technology that now is on U.S. Air Force bases, and is used every day.
Well, the technology sounds so promising that we almost get a Star Trekian hope that maybe one day money will not be necessary, that every person will have access to clean drinking water, and everyone will be able to take care of themselves and their families without having to marshal armies and charge across the frozen tundra at one another for some piece of ground or access to a river. My guest has been Alfred Lambermont Weber. He is the head of the Institute for Cooperation in Space. That website is peaceinspace.com. His website is exopolitics.com, and he's got a book which is called Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. That book is for sale at Amazon.com. It's also for sale at his website. And he conducts a radio program every Friday night, Exopolitics Radio, and that's at ExopoliticsRadio.com. So please make use of these sources of information. And we will, too, and we'll have the links at X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and also at bbsradio.com. Well, our first hour is through, and we're sitting here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington. I wanted to let you know that if you have an inkjet printer, which most of us do, you get a little tired of going to the national chain stores and spending $80 or $90 for replacement cartridges. You can always go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and click on the 123 Inkjets link, and you can pick up those very same cartridges shipped to you free for about $25. Not only that, but every time you order, you get a chance to win a free printer. Now, that's pretty cool. So that's one of our favorite sponsors, 123 Inkjets. Don't forget the name. It's pretty easy. Well, next time that black cartridge runs out, or worse, that dreaded color cartridge, just go to 123inkjets.com through X Squared Radio, and you can replace those with free shipping for a fraction of the cost. Now, my next guest is someone I know you haven't heard of, although you've heard the wind blowing on this telephone. Her name means the wind. Her name is Mariah. She is a patron here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. She's been very carefully taking notes for all the speakers we've listened to over the last 2 days. And I thought she'd be a good representative of the quality of the speakers and maybe what's impressed her most about this conference. She'll be with us for about a half an hour. And this is more or less the woman on the street interview. Mariah is a very beautiful and gracious young woman, and we trust her open mind, and we're going to just ask her a couple questions. We'll get things started. Mariah, what prompted you to come to this conference?
Well, I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I came up here with my father, who went through a spiritual awakening a few months ago. And when he did it, he was getting so much information brought to him that he had to spout it almost. He had to get it out. And my mom thought he was going crazy. My older sister thought he was crazy. And I was the only one that thought I should support him and sit down and listen to everything he had to say. So taking in all the information that he was spouting out, it pretty much forced me into my own spiritual awakening, which I always knew. I was always a little bit wiser, I guess, than people my age. I've been told that. So I always had what I thought was common sense about things. But having my dad tell me, you know, this is what I know to be truth, it came so clear to me that that became truth to me also. And so he introduced me onto a video onto the internet of James Gilliland and asked me to come up here with him. And it was when I first saw the video with James Gilliland, it really inspired me by some of the things he said. One in particular would be that, you know, we break all these things like ghosts and UFOs and, you know, global warming into different groups, when actually it's all one group. And I thought that was very inspiring, that very true to me. So that's why it really prompted me to come up here.
Well, that sounds very inspirational, that something a dad could do, some awakening that he had, and I guess this sort of shifted his paradigm a little bit. I assume, you know, he went to church now and then, and he believed in the same Bible everyone else believes in for a while, and then something happened in his life. Not that that was wrong, but that maybe there was something more. Maybe that there was a relationship between him and the universe, or between him and the earth, or maybe between him and the future or the past that sort of awakened him. And this is not an uncommon awakening. Conferences like this all over the world are happening right now. And I have to tell you that the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington, this is the second year that it's happened. It is run by James Gilliland. It's easy to find by going to eceti.org. It's eceti.org. And if you go there, you can find out about what events are going to come up here in the next 6 months. And maybe you can make your way up here. He calls it a sanctuary, where people can come and try to learn a little bit more about UFOs, about their relationship between us and past civilizations, or future civilizations for that matter. I guess my next question to you is, of the things that you've heard over the last 2 days, and there's one more day to this conference, of the things that you've heard the last 2 days, what has opened your mind the most that you've heard?
Well, a lot of what I heard, I've actually heard from my dad when he was spouting, like I said. So it really was more of confirmation for me coming in and hearing that other people are having the same feelings that he was having and that now I'm having. And with my group of friends, I have a large group of friends, but a small group of them are going through the same things that I am. And so having people on both sides, knowing people on both sides that don't really get it and then people that really do get it, it was actually really nice to come up here and meet everybody here that gets it, you know, everybody gets it, and it was so refreshing to me. And the things that touch me most, just everybody's personal stories, I think it always touched me. I've been told that I'm an empath, so I can feel other people's energy, and just the way they light up when they tell their stories or how passionate they are about why they're here and what they're speaking about really inspires me and really makes me want to listen to what they have to say.
The feeling that you get that you were talking about, you're a young person, I think very representative of the young people that are coming to the earth at this time. The curiosity that you have seems to be a different curiosity than that of youth of, say, ages past. Most of them have been concerned about, gee, what am I going to do for a living? Who am I going to marry? What kind of car do I want? But the new generation of youth that seems to be coming along has a deeper concern. And they seem to have a deeper awareness. They're not so locked into maybe what we call the three-dimensional world or the solids world. They're more aware of relationships between people or the unlimited potential of humankind. And they also seem to be intensely peaceful in their desires and their hopes for the future of the world. And I have to tell you that when we talk about militaries or governments or even the educational institutions, the rulers of those groups right now are going to die. They're going to grow old. They're going to go away. And they've got to be replaced by young people. And those young people are your age right now. I have to tell you that I have great hope for the human race as I look to your generation, that the brightness, the awareness, the hopefulness, and the love that is in the heart of this group of young people is inspiring, and it's reassuring. My question to you is, as a representative of that group, let's call them star children, for lack of a better word, what do you see in the youth of your contemporaries? Do you see that same hope? Do you see that imagination, that that ability to shed the paradigms of the old and take on some of the new? What do you see?
Well, I do hope that other people my age do feel the way I do. I've met a lot of people that my age that agree with what I say. It's almost like common sense to us. It's pretty much, the best way I could put it, it's like we just got out of school, so we just got through all the history and stuff, so we learn from it, and it seems like people that are older than us kind of forgot to learn from the history of, you know, Rome, what happened with the Roman Empire, and things like that. We can't keep doing that, and we can still see it happening almost. And so we know that we need to change it, and we know that, hopefully we know that we are the future. I mean, we can't just depend on our children after us. We are the ones that have to do it, and I pray to God that people my age do know that also.
Well, it's funny that you should bring up the word God. Most of us here in this country, when we associate the word God, we immediately want to pick up the Bible. So we'll just pick it up here for a second. It seems that most people believe the Bible was written by a group of prophets or even apostles, or the epistles were at least written by holy men. And the outline that they have in the Bible we call it eschatological. It means that we're kind of on an irrefutable prophetic path toward Armageddon, that we're marching without any variation or deviation from some timeline that a deity has laid out for us through prophets. They were eventually going to march to a valley called Armageddon, and we're going to blow the heck out of each other. And then Christ is going to come down and cleave the Mount of Olives, and everybody's going to be worshiping him forever. But I heard in your voice and in your words that as young people, you almost have a common sense view that, now, wait a minute. We already know that future. We already see that one written in the manuscripts. We've had it preached to us since we could go to Sunday school our very first day. The youth of the world today believe, I think in their hearts, what you're telling me, is that you can just turn slightly and march a new path. That we don't have to march to the Valley of Armageddon and launch missiles at each other and follow that path. That there is a new future that you have brought to us with your innate wisdom and your love and your desire for this future. What confidence do you have? What tells you inside that you can march to a different future, one that the prophets and maybe your Sunday school teachers didn't tell you about?
Well, actually, what I believe actually was taught to me in Sunday school is that God gave us free will, okay? So if someone is a prophet and has a vision that says this is going to happen in the future, by finding out that it's going to happen, that changes the future right there, because we are now aware. If we were not aware before, we could just step into those footprints and lead us to that destination. But now that we're aware of it, it changes the timeline completely. You can't... how to explain it? I guess... Okay, let's see. So, like what you were saying was that... Because we take it from the Bible and from prophets, is written, that most people believe it was written by prophets. Well, I heard a speaker today actually say a very good line where it tells you, go ahead, speak to God. Speak to God all you want, but if he answers back, it's the devil. Well,
that's pretty good.
Well, if we took the word of those prophets that decided to write the Bible, well, those were men, and if someone stood up today and said, God is talking to me and he told me to write this book, what would most people turn to him and say? You're crazy. Why have we spent so many years following what we would say today, it would be a crazy person saying.
Well, let's talk about that word awareness. Besides your father, you say that your siblings did not pick up the same message that he picked up. Obviously, they're not here with you at this conference. What is it that has made you aware? What is awareness to you?
Awareness to me would be, awareness. It's knowing. You know, if you get a little bit of knowing a little fact of something, then you are aware of it. You know, you can't be aware of something you don't know. It's not possible. And so once you know that it's there, or you can't, some people I've heard that were, back when when Columbus sailed over the ocean, the Indians couldn't actually see the ships on the water because they had no idea what a ship was until a shaman sat there and watched the waves breaking and said, what is that? And finally he saw the boats and went up to each person and put his finger on their forehead and said, they're boats, they're ships, that's what they are, and then they could see the ships. So without someone who knows more than you do, obviously a teacher, you need someone to teach you. We only know what people can tell us, and people can only learn what we know.
You know, Jesus once said that if we just had the faith of a mustard seed, we could say to the mountain, be thou removed, and it would be so. Now, I don't advocate going around removing mountains just because we want to see it move. I kind of like looking at Mount Adams right here behind us, that this is a beautiful conference. But what he was trying to teach us was all we really had to do is be aware of our abilities. And as you said, this knowing, not a suspecting, nothing wavering, that we know our relationship, we know our abilities, we know our power, we know our responsibility. I guess my question to you is, since you've been here at the conference, what has helped your awareness? What's helped your knowing? What have you learned since you've been here?
Well, the first thing out of the, when I heard I was going to do an interview, is the first thing I wanted to tell people is that when you first show up, it is like jumping into a pool on a hot day. It is so refreshing, the energy of this place, the energy of the people around you, that you, it's hard to explain. Like, it's just so refreshing, and,
What did you learn?
What did I learn? Oh, learning. Okay. What I learned is that there's so much out there. You know, there's so much to know that we should know, and I learned, especially from the speakers here, that so much has been kept from us, and most people know that so much has been kept from us that we're kind of like children almost, because there's so much more to know that we don't know yet. It's so massive, but just learning it excites me. I love taking in knowledge. I'm a student of life. You know, everything, every moment, every day teaches you something and changes the person that you are to be better, I think. There are things that happen in your life that you may not think make you better, that may be bad experiences, but later on you can look back and you learn the lesson from that, absolutely. Every time you feel pain, every time someone hurts your feelings, every time you feel joy, every time you love, you know, you learn. And so I'm always learning, but mostly that I've learned here is that there's so much more. You can't stop. There's not going to be an end of knowledge. There's not going to be it's eternal, I guess. It just keeps going and going. It's not going to stop.
So do you think the potential of the human spirit is limited, or do you think it's unlimited? Do you feel like I guess I'm going to ask you a question. You don't have to give me all the details if you don't want to, but I ask this question a lot. And you can say anything you want, but what is your dream? What is your dream?
My dream is the truth, for everyone to know the absolute truth. Truth is light. Light is love. Love is great, you know, it's all important, and all of the BS that we've been fed for so long if you let it can make you sick, I think. And so what my dream is that everybody gets to hear the truth and know the truth and believe the truth, and that way they can be free almost. It's freeing, it's absolutely freedom. Truth is freedom, and that's what I dream. For myself and for everyone.
I don't think you could have spoken it any better. Mariah, I'm going to do a little aside here. I'm going to go to your dad for a second. So you want to trade places and let me sit your dad here? Because it turns out, I think, that Dad is the one that had this awakening. And he started, as Mariah was saying, spouting all of these things. And everybody at the breakfast table thought Dad was losing his mind, except Mariah. And he's here. So I want to ask you a question a little bit about how did this awakening process occur to you? Did you have a near-death experience? Did you wake up one day and just see a new light? Tell us about how this awakening came.
Thank you, Brooke. My awakening came with a trigger, and that trigger was watching a video of a young girl whose name was Akiana. It still is, Aki. I'm sorry. She was so truthful. If you haven't seen her or seen her paintings, she was a young girl who started drawing at the age of 4, and she began to paint pictures of heaven. And she said, "These are what my memories are. These are my memories of heaven. There is a God. There is, and God is love. Love totally, completely, of everything and everyone. There is no judgment. There is only love. So give yourselves a break, folks. You are perfection. Even though you are human, you are a part of God. And that God is in the Bible. And it is... it's so wonderful. All I can tell you is that I am filled with love. And it's not a sexual love. It is a totally pure love. And it is for every being, every plant, every animal, every rock, the soil. And we have to live this life minute by minute. Don't worry about what happened 5 minutes ago. Don't worry about what's happening 5 minutes from now. Live your day, moment to moment. Enjoy every moment. You know, that reminds me, Mark, of a couple of stories. One was an art class, a third grade art class, and the teacher just asked kids to draw anything they wanted to draw. Well, this little girl was very intent on her drawing, and the teacher said, I think her name was Susie, "Susie, what are you drawing?" "Oh, I'm drawing a picture of God." And the teacher said, "Well, Susie, that's kind of silly. Nobody knows what God looks like." And she said, "They will in a minute." And the other question is a little bit about, as that second story comes to me, I'm going to ask you another question. In thinking about star children, first of all, how old is Mariah?
She's 22.
All right, Mariah is 22 years old, going on 70, I think, as far as wisdom goes. What hope we have with young people like Mariah and their great wisdom and their great ability to learn and to teach, and, as she says, and to know. This hope is absolutely amazing. The art and this person that you're talking about, what was her name again?
Akiana.
Was this the trigger that got you started? But then how did you seek more knowledge? Obviously, going to work every day and learning the things, or accepting the things that you've been taught your whole life as the way things were. You know, you're going to live, you're going to grow old, you're going to get sick, and you're going to die. And that's about it. Get your 401k built so your kids will have something. Obviously, that wasn't cutting it for you anymore. Where did you go from there to try to learn and grow and understand about your awakening?
I listened to many radio programs. What everyone should know is I was in the depths of despair, a deep, deep depression because of pain. And I was on medications up the wazoo, if I can say that. It came to be that I wasn't living the normal life. I was tired. I was always sick. I was tired of feeling pain. I almost wanted to end it, but I didn't have the nerve. But I don't think it was nerve. It was common sense. Why should I end my existence when existence is so beautiful? Now, I didn't think it was beautiful until I saw these pictures. And the pictures inspired me. And not only the pictures, but the words of the little girl, who grew up, by the way, in a family of atheists. God was not spoken in the house of or about. And she changed her parents. While the parents were trying to teach her, she taught the parents. So, but it's the hope is in our children. But we are all children, okay? We are learning every day, and because of that, you, if you're 70 years old and listening to this, you're a child. Come to that joy of being a child and the love that you knew then for your parents, and the love that you have for your children. But understand that everyone is your child, is your brother, is your sister, is your mother, is your father, because we are one. We are energy. We are all the same beings. We are separate, but we are one. And hopefully everyone can awaken to this.
It's not that I'm special. I am Joe Blow. I was a machinist. I didn't even think he mentioned something about going to church once in a while. No, I'm sorry, I didn't. It wasn't that I didn't believe, but it just stopped long ago. So the belief is gone for that. It doesn't have to do with belief. It has to do with truth. Because when truth is, you know truth, just as you know when someone's trying to blow smoke. Truth is everything. It is light. It is peace. It is love. It is wisdom. And it's not a complicated thing. It's so simple. It's common sense. And that's what the young people have today is common sense. They don't believe the crap that we were taught because what we were taught is so unbelievable that they can't even have a conception of what that could possibly be. They see the truth as it is.
Mark, one final question. You've been here now 2 days at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. What has impressed you about it? What's your favorite thing that you've learned while you've been here?
The favorite thing that I've learned is something that I've known, but I've relearned it. Person-to-person contact. Interaction between human beings. This is what we were made for. We weren't made to hide in our homes. We weren't made to hide in our apartments. We weren't worried about the bad side of town. There is no bad side of town. Don't be afraid. Don't fear anything. This isn't the end. This isn't the only time we're here. And you're loved. No matter where you are, if you're sitting at home alone, you're loved. I love you. Mariah loves you. Brooke? Yeah, he loves you too.
All right. Thank you very much, Mark and Mariah. Just the patrons that come here, they came from New Mexico up here to learn and to be exposed to some of the teachers that have been here. We're going to have another one on here. It's one of the most fantastic artists I've ever seen. We met him at the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles in February. Many of us have had dreams of other worlds, maybe even planets we might have lived on at one time. And maybe we sat down with a pencil or a piece of charcoal or made crayons and we've tried to paint that world. Well, we're going to hear from Douglas Taylor. I've got to tell you, there's hope for every one of us. If Douglas Taylor can end up as the class of artist that he has, just about anybody can do it. That's not an affront to you, Douglas, but he didn't grow up in an artistic family. He didn't grow up as a painter. Far from it. He's going to tell you a little bit about his life story. And Douglas, maybe prior to becoming an artist, what did you do?
Prior to becoming an artist, I was pretty much focused on one thing, and that was being able to escape whatever pressures I felt around me growing up, through going through high school and having to deal with, you know, the Vietnam War, and then having to deal with, you know, making a living. And all those various pressures kept me focused on one way that I could escape that, and that was through going surfing. And so that's what I did, and I basically just wanted to surf. I didn't want to do anything else. As soon as I went out into the ocean, I was like plugged into this incredible, joyful, positive state of consciousness, and so that was it, you know, and it kind of continued on from there that eventually, probably age 19 or 20, no longer was surfing kind of giving me that sense of well-being that it had so much up to that point in time. And I started seeing that I needed something more. And at that same point in time, I started having experiences where I began to have out-of-body experiences, leaving my body during dream state. And being very scientifically minded, not being a scientist in a professional way, but being very interested in the science behind it, I began to really research into these experiences I was having.
So when you started doing the research as a natural-born scientist, only not professionally trained scientist, you reached after maybe technology at first, and somehow that had to feed the artistic side of you. Well,
I kind of think of that as a left brain, right brain thing in my mind. I used to think things through left brain, you know. First this item and then that item, and then we're going to build a machine, or we're going to build a tool, or we're going to build a building. And I know you've got that of your mind, but where did the artistic part come from? How did you go from paddling through seawater and then having these out-of-body experiences to training your hand to access the visions that you were having? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think throughout history, artists have tried to describe and explain the experience of expression, creative, and, you know, their own inspiration and their creative expression, how that process takes place and how it could come about. And from my perspective, it happened in a very unusual way, because I hadn't been interested in art at all. And I was, like I said earlier, I was somewhat blocked off from any other aspects of life other than, you know, very focused in one particular area. And so as I began to have those various experiences that I was talking about, I noticed that there was a certain intuitive guidance. There was something there that was leading me to certain books, to certain areas when I would go on my travels, where these experiences would be accelerated. And I actually had an experience on the island of Puerto Rico where I was taken aboard a starship. I was on a surfing excursion there in 1977, and I was telepathically transported into the ship and communicated with seven individuals. And this just burned a picture in my mind that was so intense in its effect on my life that I could not even really begin to describe it other than the way that I've tried to. But the picture was so intense, but it was because it was associated with a feeling of upliftment, of exhilaration, of what I've now come to understand as creativity, of inspiration. And all of these elements were things that I was not aware of. I had no real contact with them. So this was, in a sense, just a huge kickstart to my own, what I would call my spiritual development, my spiritual progression in a certain way. And as I was inside the craft and they began speaking with me and talking to me telepathically about how the craft functioned, again, the experience didn't last that long. And I probably won't go into it right at the present time, but as I did come back from the experience, I found myself laying on my bed, the crystal clear memory of everything that had just transpired, and the clarity of these individuals who I met was such that I saw them not, they were human looking, and yet they had this light that was radiating around them. And I didn't understand really what that was at the time, but there was just this sense of a tremendous intelligence. And so it was almost like they imparted a certain amount of their intelligence into me to kind of give me a jump start on my own lifetime to begin to be able to connect with that positive energy. And it was about a month after this experience, as I had been telling my friends about it, and I was talking to people, and I was just floating for months. I wasn't in my body, in a sense. I was just so transcended. And I sat down one day, and I woke up from sleep, and I just said, wow, I feel like drawing something, never having drawn before. And I started drawing a spaceship and a wave, you know, and like a little scene, a little like panorama of a particular world. And that was kind of the beginning. But I noticed when I was doing the drawing that I again felt that same upliftment, that same sense of inspiration, and that tremendous exhilarating feeling of doing something that had a meaning, that had a purpose, that my life suddenly had this tremendous purpose behind it. And at the time, I didn't know what it was, obviously, but this was about 30 years ago. So since that time, it's kind of evolved into a much, much deeper understanding of what I would call certain scientific principles that function within all human beings, and as a means of developing a alignment and awareness of how those principles function, we align ourselves with the natural progression of what you could call God, what I would call the infinite intelligence or nature, and as you develop that alignment with it, it guides your life in ways that are extremely creative and give you a sense of inspiration that just is beyond your previous belief system of what reality could be.
Well, that sounds very inspirational. I see that these out-of-body experiences that you have, you're on a surfing excursion, you have an ET experience, and you receive communications that obviously through your language have changed your perspective. They've changed your paradigm of accepting what is the role of a human being. Who are we in the universe, and are we alone in the galaxy or in the universe? But then sitting down one day to draw, I think I've done that a few times myself, but without AutoCAD, trust me, you wouldn't want to see any of my drawings. But I've been to your website, and it's solicjourneys.com. That's S-O-U-L-I-C, journeys.com. And I've also seen your artwork and pretty good-sized prints of it at the various conferences where I've seen you. And your work is absolutely stunning. It has depth. It has color. It is unique in the sense that it represents seascapes and landscapes and of planets that are not of this world. The view of the planets and the stars and the sky is different. It is a blend of contemporary sea life, like whales and things like that, and seascapes and cities and spacecraft and all in the same painting. And I've got to tell you, I've sat down and just lost myself in your paintings. So what you have been called to do with the scientific journey that you've had in your mind and the artistic things that have come out of your hands is greatly affecting the universe. So when you come to these conventions and you're here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference lecturing, besides telling people how you have artistically expressed your out-of-body experiences, these visions that you've had, because I don't see any erasures anywhere on these paintings. They just seem to flow out of you. And the art is, I'm telling you, listeners, it is not abstract. It is almost as though you're looking out of a camera view of a spaceship at another world. And the detail in these is phenomenal. It's breathtaking. It's stunning. I don't know how long it took him to paint these. I guess my question is, the philosophy that's coming out in your art, how do you do the spoken word part of this? How does it tie the human being into your art? That's my question.
It's pretty simple, really. What took place with me, as I look at it now in retrospect, so many years ago when I began having these experiences, and what it really comes down to is that everybody has this connection with what you could call their creative nature, their spiritual nature. You know, everybody has their own kind of description as to what it is. And people can call it God, they can call it whatever they want to. And yet, in my case, what I have learned, which has been so tremendously beneficial to me, is that I had really major blockages within the actual conduit of my consciousness that are something like a blockage in a drain pipe, and that there has to be some way of clearing that blockage in order for the water to begin to flow. And so that spiritual intelligence is always flowing. It's actually recreating the very physical body and everything that exists itself, and yet mentally we can become very blocked. And what I found is that those blockages, in essence, were certain aberrations that I had set in motion both in this lifetime and in previous lifetimes. So it goes into a very deep, in-depth understanding that we obviously can't go into right at the moment. But it, in a simple vein, I could just describe it as the fact that I had learned that in previous lifetimes and even in this lifetime, I had been very, very selfishly inclined. I'd been desirous of my own selfish needs. I was not concerned about my fellow human beings living on the planet. And so those selfish attitudes create a block against the natural flow of this creative principle of inspiration, or of how the functioning evolution of nature actually works. And so I was in opposition to it. It created these blocks. I had to recognize them. person as I recognized them, and in a sense they would be very deflating to my ego, to my identity of who I was, thinking I was this little human running around on this planet. But there was a much greater perspective that I began to delve into and to begin to comprehend, and that had to do with the fact that as I had been involved in various nefarious activities, that those negations and the input that they had created within my psychic body could be removed, and that I could be healed. And I really discovered this through a series of books. I've been reading books, obviously, all my life, very fascinated with the subject matter. And a particular school that I have to give credit to was the Inaris Academy of Science, who was founded by Ernest L. Norman and Ruth E. Norman. And it was in their books, really, that I discovered how this process really functions and really works. And I had to really look at myself and see that my ego was my worst enemy, that I, my lower self, was my worst enemy, and that as I worked that out, as I created a better life for myself by working these things out, it was helping the people and the planet as a whole. And then this creative side began to flow in a much, much more easy and flowing fashion. So I wasn't one of those people who came to the planet, you know, already, so to speak, clear of all these different, the debris of all this different negation. I was one who had helped to create it. And in recognizing that, it gave me a means of unplugging those clogs and those blocks. And so then the inspiration could flow and I could get back to a level. In other words, I'd reversed myself in my own evolution, so to speak. And I could begin to develop back to a level that I had been on previously.
You expressed in your words a great desire that came over you to help humanity, to try to do something wonderful for the human race. And I'm going to tell you, your art has a way of doing that for me. When I hang it on the wall, or when I open a book, when I look at even the small prints of what you have, the detail in these, I can't describe what it does to me. It frees me from the confines of this world, and it opens me up to, for lack of a better word, it opens me up to memories that I seem to have of places beyond this world, maybe even beyond this galaxy for that matter, that do involve at least the symbols of what you have in your paintings. What exchange have you had as you create this art, as you're sitting there drawing it, or you're sitting there painting it, or filling in the outline? I'm not sure what your artistic process is. How do you feel an exchange between what you're doing and what benefit the universe or the race of man is going to get from viewing your art, if they purchase your art and hang it in their gallery, hang it in their office, or in their hallway going down their house, or set it up on a stand in their living room? How do you feel that you are affecting the human race with your art?
The main thing, I guess, that I've learned is that everything carries a specific frequency, you know, and that is delving into maybe more of a scientific aspect of something that seems like it's not related to science, but I believe everything has a relationship to science and its expression. And so the frequency is always relative to the energy that was put into it. So although we see the world through a specific framework of perspectives, you know, with our five senses, in reality we're picking up light waves, sound waves, sense waves through our fingertips, and all of these different waveform energies are not really, in a sense, what we are looking at. They are just what we have created, in a sense, through our past experiences, and now have agreed that this is what we're looking at. So you can begin to open the aperture of the camera a little bit, and then that frequency is now raised up slightly. And so as that process is taken on into the process of creating a painting, what I would hope, not that this is always the case, obviously I'm not always going to be inspired when I'm painting, but it usually is a very uplifting experience. I don't, you know, it's not like I want to sit down and paint a bunch of devils and Satan and, you know, different images that don't tune me into something positive. There's enough people doing that already, you know. I can just kind of focus on what I like to do. But the main thing that I would hope that it does is that it carries that positive frequency, and it's carrying the energy from where that came from. And as you were describing, you know, what really takes place in my mind, it's really just a channel ship. It's just being aware that you're functioning as a channel, and the more humble you can be, the more opportunity there's going to be that somebody of a more intelligent nature can contact you, because those more intelligent people living on these higher dimensions are the most humble people on the planet. Not for any other reason than that that is just strictly the way that the principles of infinite intelligence function, that the lower ego is like a little ball of energy that has to be expanded in order for more intelligence to be able to come in. It's like the glass itself, you know. It's, if you believe your glass is full, you can't put anything else in it. And so I think that's kind of the nature of what I've been discovering is, and I still obviously go through this process all the time where I have preconceived ideas, I think I know it all. You know, it's a constant process to try to deflate that ego, because the further along you go, sometimes the more you think you know, and that can be a real detriment to being able to be open to new information.
Besides the artistic technique it obviously takes to create a painting of this quality, and by the way, you can go to soulicjourneys.com and you can look at a whole gallery of things that Douglas Taylor has painted. On the computer screen, they'll take your breath away, but when you hold one in your hands and look at it, you're going to feel like you could just wade out into the water and you could actually look up in the sky and see what he sees. Besides this artistic technique it takes to create this, when you extend yourself out into the maelstrom of creativity out in the universe and you're trying to get this inspiration to do something with this canvas or this medium with which you work, what is the connection that you feel? Is it great love? Is it a desire to instruct people on maybe the higher purpose of life or the higher opportunity of mortality? What is it that you feel when you connect in to create a painting?
I think that the feeling itself is really the most important factor. And, you know, in other words, you know, I haven't been successful in selling my art. You know, I work as a carpenter, and I love my work. And really what I've discovered is that painting and building a house are extremely similar. You know, you begin with the foundation when you're building a house, and it's the same with a painting, you know. And so anybody who's done both can kind of see that there is a definite similarity there. And yet at the same time, when I'm sitting down and I'm allowing myself to let that creative energy flow through me, it is the most uplifting feeling that I get in my life. I mean, it's like that seems to be what life is all about to me. So it doesn't matter whether I sell the painting or not. It doesn't matter whether anybody else sees it or thinks, you know, anything about it. What really is important is what am I learning in this process, because in the long run, that's all that's really important. And then the other aspect of it is what we've spoke about a little bit. Hopefully, other people will see it as something of a trigger that will bring memories to them in some way, that will help them in some way, so that what I'm doing is actually benefiting, you know, other people in a way that maybe isn't tangible to me at the time and maybe is not important for me to even be aware of. But if that's happening, then it's serving its purpose, and that makes me extremely happy.
You know, I believe everything we do eventually affects the universe, and I guess in my life, how I've tried to do that, besides the projects that I work on, is with words. I wrote one time, the word is the key to the natural hide amidst pictures from those who cannot paint and music from those who cannot play. With it, the power of the mind is infinite. So I try to do that here on X Squared Radio and with the books that I write, but I have to tell you, it doesn't come close to being able to paint the picture that you can paint. I've seen lots of art. I've walked through lots of galleries, and I can just tell you, I can't think of a single home in this country that doesn't need one of these paintings hanging in it. unfortunately, with the world of artists and art that's out there, it seems that the artist first has to pass away before his art becomes valuable. And maybe it's that way with music, too, a la Kurt Cobain. But this doesn't need to be this way. With the medium that we have today to show people a sample of your art anywhere in the world, just by going to solicjourneys.com, I would think that they would have an immediate desire to get out that credit card and to buy one of these prints and send it to a friend or to have it for themselves. If you have ever had the desire that you've been connected or dreamt of another world, another seascape, another view of the heavens that doesn't look like the one we see when we look up at the Milky Way, frankly, being out on the edge of the Milky Way next to this tiny little main sequence sun that we have that comes up every 24 hours over our planet, it's kind of dull and kind of boring when you think about the skyscapes that are available just by buying one of Douglas Taylor's paintings. These are extremely reasonably priced. I was recently in Mount Shasta, and I was walking down the street, walked next to a gallery, and there was a very interesting painting in the window of a planetary scape, much like that I imagine owning. I walked in to inquire of the price, and when I learned that I probably drive a vehicle that costs less than the painting, I decided that the best way to have that kind of quality of art in my office was to buy a Douglas Taylor work, and that's what I'm going to do here. That's what my friends do, and it's what I recommend you do. And I'm telling you, it's not a commercial for Douglas Taylor paintings, but if you've ever felt a connection like that, that is something that you should do. You should go to Solic Journeys, S-O-U-L-I-C, journeys.com, and we'll have the link at X Squared Radio. We don't get a commission for any of this. We're just trying to affect the universe and make sure that that Douglas gets his work out there and he receives the remuneration that he needs to keep going with this kind of artwork. Trust me, I've been around maybe more than you. I travel maybe a lot more than you do, the people that are listening to this, and I've seen good art. This is it. And not only that, he's got the philosophy to go with it. One of the pieces that you do is a rendition of a male body next to a female body and the layout of the chakras in the various bodies with a vortex between them. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create this art and how this ties into your lectures.
Yeah, that is probably, you know, one of the most important diagrams that I have for my lectures, because it relates to something that has become sort of an educational process over the last 25, 30 years in understanding about, you know, the human condition, the human, not only the physical body, but what is basically related, what you're talking about, is the psychic body. And so this psychic body everyone has, and it basically is a body of pure energy, and it functions according to very definite principles that are not relative to the physical sight that we have or any of our physical senses. But in a sense, it's all of the accumulated information that we've experienced throughout this lifetime and many other lifetimes. And so that's why I depict it in the way that I do, as these vortexes of energy. And so each one of these vortexes of energy within the psychic body is relative to various both past lifetimes and also the recreation on a moment-to-moment basis of the physical body. So when there's something out of alignment with the psychic body as it's re-expressing itself into the physical form, then it shows up as either it can be a cancer, it can be a mental problem, it can be any number of different types of problems, but it's always going to be a block of some sort from your own spiritual progression, from being able to progress yourself in a more positive direction. And so that's why it's so important to understand how that particular psychic body is the true transmitting source from which you're picking up the picture of your physical body. It's very much like the transmitter of a television station, and the television set is receiving the picture, and so you see the image on the screen, but it's really all these electronic impulses. Well, it's the same with the psychic body. It's all these electronic impulses that are being recreated, in a sense, reformed and reshaped into a physical body so that we can gain the understanding we need in this particular world to have the proper body to function in this world, and then to carry on from there, gain the knowledge and information we need so that we can raise the frequency of that psychic body to a slightly higher level, and then the physical body also responds. And as that frequency level continues to increase, eventually we no longer even need to come back into a physical body. We'll carry on in a state of consciousness that is on a much more developed, much higher level. Everything will be relative to that higher level. And so that's really the importance of that particular diagram, is that that psychic body is something that everyone has. You maybe can't see it, but it is actually the recreative force or the transmitting source of our present physical body.
You know, when I think about the physical body and how it aligns to the energy that's inside of us, I've heard it described that maybe we're just a ball of energy, and that we assume this physical form, or we occupy this physical form as some kind of a temple or some kind of an expression of that ball of energy, but we don't really look like this. But my feelings are, inside of me, I maintain that we actually make ourselves look the way that we look. Basically, one skeleton is just like another skeleton. But how we move our muscles, or how we comb our hair, or how we eat and how we exercise, it changes our shape. It shapes us into who and what we really are, not that face that we shave in the morning or that hair that we shampoo in the shower, but the being that's inside of us, that animates us, that energy body that's inside of us. And I feel that you're exactly right, that the expression of that body, whether it's healthy or whether it's sick, whether it's fat or whether it's skinny, whether it's health or whether it's athletic or sedentary, is an expression of the energy body that's inside of us. Do you think that we are individual energies, or that we're part of some giant cosmic energy and that we're just an individual expression of that giant cosmic energy? Do you think we are individual intelligences?
Well, absolutely. We all have our own personalities, and we have our own identity, you know, as to who we are. Now, that identity, I think, is formed and shaped by our perceptions of who we've been and where we've come from. And so all of the various experiences that we've had are, in a sense, reestablishing a sense of reality as to who we are. And exactly what you're talking about, we create the shape of who we are. We create the world that we live in. And so that absolutely is quite factual, in that if we want to change the world, if we want to do something to improve upon the way that we see things happening, you know, we have to get out and do something to change it. It's the same thing with our psychic body. It's the same thing with the essence of how we want to change our life. We get stuck in these patterns where we keep repeating the same situations over and over and over again. And that situation in itself can be such that we dig a hole for ourselves, or it's like the groove of the record gets dug in so deep that it just keeps going around and around. So it's like, how do you break free of that groove and pull it out and put it on another part of the record so you can hear the sweet celestial music again? And, of course, that is relative to the fact that I totally believe that we are all a part of this great, infinite, creative intelligence. And although it is a huge, vast energy system beyond our wildest comprehension, we always will maintain a sense of identity as to our own personality, and yet we become a much greater part of the greater whole as we become more aware of what it is, how we function within it. And yes, I totally believe that we are all a part of a much, much greater picture, and that picture can only begin to be focused and crystallized in our mind as we understand a larger perspective and as we can open our panorama and the aperture of our mind so that it can allow in more light without flooding us to where we're blinded by it.
Yeah, I understand that almost allergic reaction that people can have when they're exposed to too much light all at once. It's sort of like walking out of a movie theater in the middle of the day and your eyes are used to the darkness of the theater, and you walk out and you've got to squint, you've got to put sunglasses on, something. It's almost painful. It's just too much light. But I can tell you that part of the preparatory process
to get somebody ready to receive more light is maybe to listen to the right music, or maybe to look at the right painting, concentrate on the window that it opens for your imagination. We have been conditioned by government schools, or by our parents, or by our neighbors, or by our preacher, that the world is a certain way. But something inside of us tells us there's a little bit more to that. There's a little bit more to us, and there's a little bit more to the world, and there's a little bit more to the universe. I think part of that process, part of that opening of the window, is to look at artwork that's been created by someone who has reached out there and got a vision and brought it back and had the skill with their hands to put it to canvas, so you don't have to draw it for yourself. All you really have to do is open your eyes and look, and you will begin to be prepared to receive more light. Douglas Taylor's website is solicjourneys.com, S-O-U-L-I-C, journeys.com. We'll have the link at X Squared Radio. I promise you, there's a print just big enough to fit on your desk if you're sitting there at your computer working on your favorite project this morning. Or if you're listening to us live, just go to the website now. Order the painting. He'll ship it to you this week, and you'll have it for yourself. Trust me, there's one there for you. Douglas, I appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing you and your lovely wife to the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. I've really enjoyed hearing you a couple times, and we're going to see you again, and we'll push some more paintings out there.
Great.
So, thank you very much. Well, it's a beautiful, sunshiny, blue day, although a little cool and crispy here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference here at Trout Lake, Washington. The latest session is about to wrap up, and we are going to have Michal Ledwith. Now, I'll bring you up to date a little bit on Michal. He was an advisor to the Pope. He taught in the Divinity School for 16 years. He was president of the seminary for 4 years. He built a library from the ground up. He has been in the Vatican. He's been looked at the vast resources, over 100,000 volumes and manuscripts that are in the Vatican. He tells me it'll take 100 years to catalog all that stuff. Nobody's even trying. So the general public really doesn't have access to it. But you know what? They don't have to, because we have access to Michal Ledwith. Now, if you haven't heard him lecture, you don't have to really go out to a conference to catch him. All you really have to do is pick up his 4-DVD set, How Jesus Became a Christ. He's getting ready to come out with his first book, and he's coming out with another DVD set in this year, actually this fall. He was also in the wildly popular, and you could go down to your local rental place and rent this, go down to Blockbuster, or go down to Movie Time, or to one of these places, and rent the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? It was extremely well marketed. And you will see Michal Ledwith in that. He's one of the principal figures in that movie. Go ahead, watch it. Get your mind expanded a little bit on where you sit in relation to the religiosity of the world. As soon as he gets done with this little gathering he has going on over here on the side of the meeting hall, maybe we can get him over here for a half-hour interview. I can tell you that there are a couple of events coming up. This coming weekend, the 9th through the 12th, we have the Heart of the Awakened. And this is in Weed, California, just slightly north of Mount Shasta City. You could either fly into Sacramento, or you could fly into San Francisco, or you could even fly into Redding. If you live in any of these areas, you're just a short drive away. Make your way up to Weed, California. Go to his website, ShalomarProductions.com, ShalomarProductions.com. The link is at X Squared Radio. It's also at BBSRadio.com. Just go to either one of those websites and you can get there. This is not a very expensive outing as far as conferences go, but you're going to hear the likes of Michal Ledwith, you're going to hear David Icke, you're going to hear myself, and you're really going to get a treat if you can make your way to this conference at Heart of the Awakened. The one that's after that is in August, the 15th through the 15th through 17th, and that is the next conference at Shalimar Productions, and then the one after that is the San Francisco UFO Bay Area Conference. That link is also at xsquaredradio.com. That's one you don't want to miss. That's the granddaddy of all UFO conferences in the country. Now, I know this is the anniversary of the Roswell crash in 1947. That was a pretty good conference if you made your way to Las Vegas, but this one is even bigger than that. This is where the big boys come, and it's in San Francisco at the convention center there. All you really have to do is go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com, click on the link to the San Francisco Bay Area UFO conference put on by Victoria Jack. She does a great job. And this is definitely the biggest UFO conference in the country. I think what we'll do right now is we'll take a quick 5-minute commercial break. If my producer is handy, he can just go ahead and plug that break in. And we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back after these messages. I don't know if my producer is listening or not. I haven't.
Hi, this is Brentwood from Legion of Love. Just letting you know you can now hear some of our new released and unreleased tracks on our website, legionoflove.com. You can also purchase our EPs, Grey Matter Tunes and Matters of the Heart, as well as all of our singles, including Shine a Light and Love is the Answer, at most major download sites. And of course, you can hear them on BBS Radio, the number one internet radio network in the world. Peace and love.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping.
Hello, everybody.
They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me. You will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You just might save the planet. Plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world, and because of their love for the earth, They are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person.
Hi, this is Marco May. I'm really glad you're listening to BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio.
And welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future, as we have been coming to you live from the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference here in Trout Lake, Washington. My guest now is Michal Ledwith. I've known him now for a year. I've seen his DVD set, How Jesus Became a Christ, and I've also been to his website many times. It's thehamburgeruniverse.com. You can also find that just by Googling his name or by looking up What the Bleep Do We Know. And by the way, you can rent that DVD at your local Blockbuster or Movie Time and bring yourself up to speed with where awareness in the world of religiosity is going. One of the things that Michal presented here was his work with orbs and his research relative to the energy of intelligence in the universe. And I guess I'm going to ask him a question and maybe he can pontificate a little bit. In your experience as a traditionally trained Christian, you reached a point in your life where you were exposed to the teachings of Ramtha, the Enlightened One. And this didn't come as a pleasant surprise to you, although you knew it was true. You kind of went through a growth experience, and it's not unlike what the average person goes through when they reach the end or maybe the middle of a 20-year exposure to whatever religion they happen to belong to. And then they realize, there's a little bit more to it than that. But with your training, with your tremendous intellect and your great heart, you were able to make this transition not only smoothly, but to become a leader in it. And I want to know how that process went for you.
How many years have we got to answer this question? I was saying to Robin here that I'm so delighted this is radio because of a hole in my sock and the listeners won't be able to see it on this medium. But that, I had a hole in my sock religiously too, which is why I mentioned the point, because I was a professional theologian for many years. I was a lecturer first, then a professor, and then dean of the faculty. I eventually became president of the university for 10 years. So I was an academic all my life, and the whole of it was designed towards discovering in some way, shape, or form the answers to the four great questions. You know, who are we? Who the heck are we anyway? Are we just this two legs and two arms and a body, or is there more? And maybe that's the most important part. Where do we come from? Which none of the religions in the West tell us anything about whatsoever, even though we know that the circumstances of our present life are dictated to the last degree by that previous experience. Thirdly, what should we do while we're here? Is it just being good or bad and being rewarded or punished by God? Is there a much grander destiny, not in the hereafter, pie in the sky, but right here and now? And it was quantum physics that got my attention on that, and that's how I ended up in What the Bleep Do We Know, because the message there was that we create reality by how we observe it. In other words, if I'm focused on victimization and the conviction that everything is doom and gloom and hard and difficult and scarce, of course I will be obliged by my consciousness by experiencing a world like that. On the other hand, if I believe that it's a glorious and powerful reality, would accommodate to that view as well. That's exactly what Jesus taught. I discovered when I looked back at all the stuff I had learned that it was the same message. So when I found Ramtha's school of ancient wisdom, thankfully I think I would be probably lying in my grave for many years by now if I had not. But when I did, I found, as a result of all my years of searching, that the gaps in the knowledge that I had previously known were filled. And even though it was a very uncomfortable transition for me, can you imagine anybody as remote from Ramtha School of Enlightenment as a member of the Vatican International Theological Commission and a university president and a Catholic priest for 30 years? If you can, please write in and let me know. But anyway, as I say, it was, you know, it was a bittersweet occasion because obviously my entire previous life, which had been built up very, very painfully, over so many years, obviously, it was no more. And that was balanced by a great joy at finding something that was meaningful. And I basically, you know, setting out my series of DVDs and books, etc., which I'm working on, I think the more people that find out about this, the better and the happier and the more free and powerful they're going to be. And I think there's a great shift happening in the world right now, such as is being pioneered by people like you. And it's a great joy, despite the turmoil involved in the transition, to be part of it.
You know, one of the things that I see, and it really doesn't take a rocket scientist to see this, is most of the conflict, if not all the conflict that has taken place in the world, is either caused by religion or is involved with religion in one way or another. And I have to tell you, as I grew up, I was taught about, oh, the sadness of the crucifixion and the suffering of the Christ and even the worthlessness of the human soul. It all in all, it looked pretty bleak for me to ever even make it to heaven, let alone have joy in my life. And I must say that you probably had pretty much the same training. In fact, probably passed that along to your students as you were revealing the written Gospels or the history behind the Gospels to your students. But you mentioned two words. One was joy, and the other one was, was the idea that there was more to the human being than maybe just the lowly mortal going to return to the dust human being that we are. Can you share with us a little bit about maybe the joyful side of the relationship between us, the individual, and the Christ, and maybe eternity? What is in store for the individual human being with respect to the divine nature of us as individuals?
Well, one of the great things that struck me about joy, and joy is absolutely the natural state of being that we should all be in. I mean, it sounds an empty platitude to say that we're so removed from that in reality. But actually, we were meant always to be in a state of joy, because it's a profound state of becoming. And not alone do we feel better, you know, mentally, psychologically, etc., but all the physical organism we inhabit starts to resonate to a different frequency if you're in a state of joy. So many of the health problems we labor under would obviously be enormously helped or maybe even obliterated if we could manage to live in that state of joy. And I was just saying to a friend here a few minutes ago about the Gospel of Thomas, which is perhaps the earliest version of Christ's teachings, in a short document of 114 verses, written by Thomas the Apostle, who was his twin brother. And the essence of it all was summed up by saying to do no harm and to only do what brings you joy. So I think that's the basic thing. You know, it's not something that we spy from a distance for a flicker of a second. It's something we should always be in. And it strikes us all, including myself, that it's rather odd that we should expect to be always in a state of joy, because that old shadow that you mentioned at the start is still hanging over us. You know, that the situation we're in here is that we're worthless sinners and we have brought all the evil into the world that we tragically know because of our sin. We first of all offended God millennia ago in the Garden of Eden, and then look what we did to his only son when he came down here to save us. So the version of Christianity that I knew, or the version I should say of Jesus that I knew when I was growing up, was all based on suffering and the accompanying guilt that came with that, and then the fear of the judgment of God in punishment. So these are the engines that drive religion, guilt and fear, and they're endless. They're, you know, we talk about pure energy sources and nuclear fusion, etc., but it's nothing compared to guilt and fear. They are the fuel that drives the engines of religion, and they will drive it endlessly. So my researches and the DVDs and so on that I'm producing is to search out the truth about Jesus, because I think his message has been radically, radically perverted. And instead of all this effort we're into of trying to make up by suffering for the offenses we've made against God. We need to realize we have made no offenses against God. That God, the Creator, wants us to explore the dimensions of this creation and to return to Him. And that means following, basically, the advice of the Gospel of Thomas, to live in a state of joy. And gradually, we may be cut out, of course, initially a few times by this, because some obnoxious person is going to get us until we develop sufficient expertise and power in that area. But eventually, if we insist on living in a state of joy, a vastly different world is going to unfold before me as an individual, and eventually it will percolate out into the entire planet. But I have always found it tragic that the very organizations that are meant to be forwarding our destiny are actually, and I am perfectly willing to concede this, that most of it's been done in absolute good faith, but they're actually forwarding our reversal in evolution rather than our progress. So from one point of view, it might seem very strange that a person with my background should be where I am today. And from another point of view, it is absolutely logical that I should be where I am today, because I spent my entire life searching for the answers to these questions, and I think I'm on their trail now, like the Hound of Heaven with Francis Thompson.
You know, I have a little bit of religious training myself, having been steeped 30 years in my own training in the church that I belong to, and also teaching in its seminary. And the lesson that, should I say, the theme that runs through everything is that you need to work out your salvation with fear and trembling before God. And the other concept is that we cannot hope to please God. Everything we do displeases Him. And I have to tell you, as I read through Gospels and even the Nag Hammadi texts and the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Book of Mormon or the Doctrine and Covenants or any of these books, I see a totally different interpretation of God and maybe even his personality traits than what I feel is true inside of me. I feel a piece of God inside of me. In fact, I feel Godhood inside of me. But that's not the God that I read about, that I see striking people of dead for shorting the tithing or wiping out whole villages because, well, not even a goat or whatever should live from it. And I don't see, really, a change in behavior between the religious leaders of the world today. What can you tell us about the nature of God and the nature of the human being and what our potentials are?
Well, when I look at the traditional documents, and not mentioning any particular religious tradition for now, but when I look at them, basically they present a picture of God who is modeled, as I said in my talk today, on the sultans and potentates of the ancient Near East, by and large. And that picture is of a being who is insecure, who's vindictive, capricious, and, I suppose, psychotic and neurotic. I mean, can anyone hope to persuade us that the God of all creation, if you had take a quick glance through the Hubble telescope, you'll see how vast even the visible universe is, which is only a tiny sliver of what exists. That the God who created all of that is as chronically insecure as we have been led to believe. Now, if you can come to see the logic of that, that obviously God is not like that. He's not an image. I've often said, and I think it's in one of my DVDs, that if elephants were pondering about God, it's highly likely they would picture God as an elephant, or an insect would probably think of God as a super insect. We think that's extremely odd, but we never think it's odd when human beings think of God as a human being, albeit enlarged, of course, and mighty and so forth, but essentially still a human being. Isn't it rather odd that we would imagine that God was a human being like us, but just a little more polished, you know, a Mark II version, and that he's going to behave, or she's, it's always a he, of course, but going to behave in that particular way. When we realize that God is neither a he, nor a she, nor an it, because these are all categories of a polarized reality, which we experience down here, but something entirely different, then I think we begin to understand that God is, in our language, which is so inadequate to speak about these realms, much more a verb than a noun, as I've put it before. Much more a personal, active, powerful energy pervading all that exists. That doesn't demean God. I mean, you may see nuclear radiations invisible, but it still will kill you. So the invisible has got a shot in the arm since all these phenomena appeared and radio and television comes out of the invisible. So the fact that God is an energy doesn't diminish God. It, in fact, enhances the way we think of God enormously. And the basic fact is that that energy is fundamentally joyous, and that what the divine energy, which is God, wants is for us to explore the dimensions of this realm we're in. And that needs to be done in joy, because if we're out of joy, we are out of the flow of what God is. Now, if you start to move as it from that point of view, rather from the old potentate of the ancient Near East model, I think we begin to see a vast new horizon which would lead us to many wonderful things. And I wish to heavens the religions would wake up to that. And if they were preaching that message, I think their fortunes would be far better than they are right now, because people are voting with their feet, and all they can seem to muster in response is to batten down the hatches all the more tightly.
Well, now that we know the nature of God, can we answer this question? Is there some all-powerful being sitting up there on a throne in the top of the universe, damning one person and blessing another person for what they know or what they own or what they eat or what they drink or who they live with? Does this being really exist in that fashion?
Well, if people want to convince me that there's such a being, I would have to ask them, where did you find this message? And if people believe that Jesus came to suffer and die for our sins in order to save us, I would ask them, where did he ever say that? Have we the slightest trace in any of the Gospels that Jesus said something even remotely like this? Surely if it's so central and important, he would have got around to mentioning it even obliquely, don't you think? In fact, there's not a word about it. And where do we find this judgmental God sitting in the heavens? Well, we don't find it basically in the core of the religious tradition at all. It's been superimposed. And if you believe in a God who is the pulsating, joyful energy of the Creator, who wants us to explore the creation and to return home enriched with that experience, how could that being then proceed to punish or damn, since all we're doing is fulfilling the basic divine imperative in creation? So if someone were to stand up before me, who's not a fundamentalist, because I don't believe in wasting my energy in dealing with people who already know all the answers before we even start the research, but if I were debating this with someone who was open-minded, I would simply start by saying, where do you find this message in terms of the source? And if you can't find them in the biblical sources even, well, then where do they come from? And should we still be honoring them instead of trying to crawl out of this snake pit we've got all immersed in and see a grander horizon?
You know, whenever I raise this, and I don't want to call it an argument, we'll call it the arousal of one's faculties, about the nature of God, and is there some being up there that has some book of life that they damn one person or bless another based on what religion they belong to or what skin color they have or what country they live in or what lineage or genealogy they happen to have or not have. It all boils down to this one concept, that of sin. Now, somebody seems to write out these rules and laws, and whether it's you don't eat fish on a certain day, or you don't eat pork, or you don't walk left-handed around a building, or you don't drink coffee, or don't, whatever these don'ts are, it all boils down to this word of sin. That somehow we can do something that will lower ourselves in the view of God. What are we really doing when we do something to harm ourselves, or we do something to harm another, or for that matter, when we do something to bless another person or to help another person? What are we actually doing?
Well, you know, in What the Bleep, I said at one point there is no such thing as right and wrong. And most people who wrote in and blasted me or tried to blast me, because I don't allow anyone to blast me, didn't listen to the following sentence. I said, there's no such thing as right and wrong because it's too low a standard. And there are people, you know, who have made a living for a lifetime out of listing all the grades of sin and the appropriate punishments to follow in judging whether someone's been guilty of it or not. It's too low a standard because that sort of casuistry can come in and, you know, dispense you from practically anything if they have the wit to do so. No, an enlightened person, I hope, would understand that there is a law of cause and effect in the universe. And if you put out something, it's going to return to you. So anything that I put out to another person or another situation or indeed to the planet itself is going to come back to me, and the structure of the universe ensures that it's magnified. So I know that I'm going to have to deal with everything that I put out. That's far higher standard than right and wrong, which is just based on some edict that some being up there somewhere said at a certain time and place, and when we examine it under the light of day, we find it was never said at all. So I would say that an enlightened being knows that everything that we say or do is going to have to be answered for, and therefore every enlightened being that ever walked this earth was eminently careful not to ever engage in anything that they would have to deal with later. That's a far higher standard than just right and wrong. And if we tried to live by that, I think we'd be far more careful and far more gainfully employed in working out our destiny than we are today. Now, turning to sin. Sin in the Greek, which is the original language of the New Testament Gospels and Epistles, is hamartia. It's a term borrowed from archery. So it's missing the target. I think most people know that today. So what is the penalty for missing the target? You try again and see if you can do better the next time. But instead, what if we've got missing the target, now God pounces upon you and sends you to hell forever because you missed the target? I mean, what would be the point of aiming at the target in the first place, except to refine your aim and to hope to improve? So these are, I said in my talk today, that many of the ultimately great and foundational teachings of Jesus have been so perverted, like forgiveness, like love, etc. These are actually tools of the quantum field that can be used to alter reality as they were originally given. Now they're commandments, which you break them, they're sins, and if you don't break them, then you get a reward, and you are written into God's book of life, which, by the way, has been exchanged now for a laptop, because he is updated like everyone else. And when the totals are found, when he presses enter, when you die, you go up or down in the hamburger universe. So it's time. We really owe it to ourselves to get out of all of this and to get on with reality as it really is. Because the realities that face us in terms of our destiny after this life are so much more magnificent and so much more joyful and fulfilling than any of these old outdated concepts could ever do, that it's a miracle to me, it's an amazement to me, that so many people find it so hard to pull up their roots and move with the times and embrace these grander realities.
In learning these things over the last year, and in watching your DVD and listening to you lecture, I've discovered that I don't really have to die to go to heaven. That I can actually make heaven right here. That I also do not have to worry much about not being perfect, because I realized I am absolutely perfect. For me, for Brooks Agnew, I am the perfect Brooks Agnew. Am I the perfect Michal Ledwith? Am I the perfect God? Am I the perfect Jesus Christ? By no means. But I'm the perfect me. And I'm complete as I am with the amount of time and service that I have on this planet and the amount of knowledge that I have and my ability to do or not do things by my choice, by my own free will. I am perfect. Yes, I do affect the universe by those things that I do or don't do, and I try to do that on purpose. I don't just try to go through life as a spectator. But as you teach, maybe those who are in positions of well, I'm going to call them positions of power, as they suppose, in government or in education, and you begin to see the change in perspective for them. I guess in your lecture today, you said they don't get out much. They need to get out more. To realize that they do have a great effect on the universe. As you teach these things to them and watch them light up and see the results of your lectures and the results of your research and your life experience. And you have a very unique and powerful perspective on this, might I add. How do you feel as they grow, as they take your knowledge and begin to step out of the shell of mortality and realize that they are immortal beings? How do you feel?
Well, you touched on a really important point there, because when you're talking about, you know, I am the perfect Brooks Agnew, etc., this is true. I prefer to phrase it maybe somewhat differently, in the sense that we should have no judgment on what we do, rather than that we have already arrived at a state of perfection, but the sense is essentially the same in both. So, I have done whatever I need to do. Maybe I hit the outer ring of the target in archery. Maybe I have hit the inner ring, or maybe I'm going for the bullseye. But basically, whatever I've done is fine. You know, there's no need to get upset, and I'm not going to be punished one way or the other. In that sense, you know, it's perfect for now. Does that mean that I have reached the fullness of perfection? Of course it does not. I think I referred in my talk today about an article in a Canadian newspaper after I spoke up there last year that said, while I had acknowledged that Jesus was a wonderful being, a great prophet, a sublime message, etc., 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 that I had said he was not God. I never said that, ever said that. What I did say was that Jesus became God not through an incarnation, but through an ascension. And that is an earth-shaking difference, even though it mightn't sound like that, because if it came through an ascension, it's technically open for you and me to accomplish as well. Now, we're never going to do that while we're tied up with sin and punishment and guilt, because that's leading us in the opposite direction to ascension, not approaching it. And if we can avail of those realities and move on, you know, we're going to enjoy the life that we have every right to enjoy. And the thing that struck me most when you were speaking was when I look at the book of Genesis in its early chapters, the first three chapters, I see there a parallel between a highly evolved, glorious state which vanished when we fell, as we put it, down to the state that we know today. But it's also in Genesis being cast forward as something for the future. So what we have in Genesis is a collapse from a high state to a low one, with an urgency to climb back to it. That's an ascension process. And in the terms of Genesis, the whole doctrine and teaching of ascension is encapsulated there. What does that mean? It means that in the original state, there was never meant to be sickness and disease and death in the creation. That something went wrong. And we know exactly what went wrong, that we were encapsulated in fear and inferiority and guilt. That is what has caused all of it to happen. So therefore, if we remove those basic causes, which focus on fear, which is the greatest magnet in quantum physics, of course, much more powerful than love, it will bring all of those things into our orbit. If we want them out of our orbit, we've got to get out of fear and all the negative things that go with us. Every great master that ever walked the earth taught that the abolition of fear was the first step in mastery. And the way to get out of fear is not saying, I must be unfearful, it's to focus on your power. Because once you see your power beginning to work, the fears will gradually die away of their own accord, like plants left to starve in the sun without water. Now, if you move into the New Testament, in St. Paul, in the Epistle to the Romans, chapter 5, verse 12, he said that death came into the world. It wasn't there originally. Now, I think this is a truth that many people who espouse the Christian tradition have conveniently forgotten, that the original dispensation is what we're trying to get back to, as Genesis said. And if we do manage to get back to that, which indeed we will, there will not anymore be a room for suffering, fear and guilt and disappointment and even death in this world. It can all be brought to a halt. And the only way we will do that is by following the teachings of Jesus, when he said, when you want to accomplish or pray for something, believe it is already yours. That's pure quantum physics. His teaching on love, his teaching on forgiveness, and many other truths were all quantum tools to do the same thing. I think if we, you know, took Jesus at his word instead of how we think he said it, we'd be much better off.
You know, you were mentioning the teachings of Paul, and I think I was recalling, it might be Hebrews chapter 5, where it says, though he were a son, yet earned he perfection to the things that he suffered. There is a conception that Jesus came to this earth complete, and that he did not need a mortal life to add anything to his stature. But in the teachings of Paul, I kind of see, maybe not a frailty, but a progression in the life of the Christ, how Jesus the Son became Jesus the Christ, and that title of Christ that he learned, maybe not through the things that he suffered, as the English version of that is, but maybe through the things he experienced. And that gives me hope that maybe through the things that I experience in this life, I'm also earning or learning a higher perfection. And so life isn't all amusement parks and blessings and great wealth. It's also a struggle and challenge and overcoming ignorance and overcoming not knowing things, trying to learn things like physics. And by the way, we're not trying to imply that you need to know quantum physics to understand these concepts. I guess my question to you is, and it'll be our final question for you, when people look at their own lives and they think, well, gee, I'm just a student, a high school student, or I'm just a housewife, or I'm just a machinist, or I'm only a dumb old carpenter, what is the human experience for them to learn about the unlimited potential of the human soul? What is that experience? What does that mean to people?
Well, really, the roles we have in life, you know, if I'm the head of a country, for instance, obviously my effect on others is far more profound and every day than if I were a carpenter or someone who's digging a garden. But, you know, in terms of our personal evolution, the dignity, if we want to call it that, or the humility of the office that we fulfill or the work that we do is absolutely irrelevant. The only thing that counts is how we embrace the experiences that come to us in those particular roles. So anyone, you know, can accomplish this thing. It doesn't matter where they're placed in life. Now, it's certainly encouraging, you know, that essentially that ongoing experience is highlighted in the letter to the Hebrews. But that is a very late letter in the New Testament, and it's highly unlikely it was written by Paul himself. But nevertheless, in many respects, it's far more optimistic than Paul's authentic epistles, because, you know, we have to basically not put a tooth in it and admit that all of the suffering and the implications about Jesus as the Savior who died for our sins, that's substantially the contribution of Pauline Christianity rather than of the Gospels. So it is something to keep in mind. That was the theme of my own DVD when I realized that more than 80% of the life of Jesus was missing from the New Testament. And if it was missing, what was going on there? And it was in his life in Egypt and in India and Tibet that he attained the dignity that he had at the end. So are we gods in the same sense that Jesus was? No, we're not. Can we become? Yes, we can. Because what's involved is realizing the divine presence into this human form. Then we are God-man and God-woman realized, and we walk the earth as such.
Magnificent, my friend. Thank you so much, Michal Ledwith. My friend, and I guess friends for life, we're going to see each other a few more times before the end of this year. There you have it. That is everything you need to know to realize that you are not a victim of religiosity or governments or schooling or prejudice or sin. You have inside of you all of the tools of the universe. You are co-creators, each of you, collectively, all the beings in the universe. All of your attention and intention applied in one massive manifestation called the three-dimensional universe. You're sensitive to much more than that, so realize that it is all reality, that it is all affected by you, whether you despair or whether you hope for prosperity, you're affected in the universe either way. And as he said, fear is a very powerful force, more powerful than love. Things that you fear, that you wake up and fear every day, you are actually feeding life into. So my advice to you, and I guess Michal's advice to you, is try to shed that fear. Master your fears first, and then move on into those things that you want to manifest. Here at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, when you come here, and I implore you to come, I guess they're going to have another one before a year, you're going to end up running into this magnificent water called Aquarius water. What makes it magnificent? I mean, isn't water just wet? Come on, you just drink it and it quenches your thirst. You mix it with Kool-Aid. You mix it with whatever, you make ice out of it. No, 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 no. What you're going to discover is a water that has capabilities way beyond what you ever thought possible. I have Cody Long here with me, and he works with Aquarius water. This factory, there's only one factory in the country that makes this water. And he's going to tell us a little bit about the unique properties of the water, and then I'm going to give you a little testimony about what it's like to drink this water for 2 or 3 days. You know, that kind of yawning feeling you get in the afternoon when you kind of run out of energy and you need a sugar rush or a caffeine rush? If you drink this water, you won't need that rush. You won't have that yawning feeling. Let's let Cody tell us a little bit about what they do differently to make Aquarius water.
Hi, Brooks. Thank you for having me on this radio show today, and I'm very grateful for being here. I can briefly start out about the water and how it was developed. It was developed by a medical doctor in Germany quite a while back, and he spent roughly 35 years of research in formulating this water. And what's unique about this water is, you know, there's a few properties that I'm going to mention here, but basically he's been able to crystallize oxygen and suspend it in the water. And what's so unique about this water is that these crystals melt only in the presence of a human being being in front of it, whereas you can treat it with sound, light, impart tons of energy on these crystals, but these crystals just melt by being in the presence of the human being. So it's a very, very unique water in aspect, and that's what makes the principality behind it of being Aquarius oxygen water. It's stabilized oxygen. It's also formulated with very precise minerals in it that your body needs to be healthy. Lakes, rivers, streams, and oceans in nature, they all touch rock. And you know, a lot of the waters out there, I'm not going to mention any of the names per se, but the processing behind the water itself, by using reverse osmosis and such, it's taking away a lot of those minerals that you need to be healthy. And so what Aquarius oxygen water does is they balance it with a precise amount of minerals in it. It's got the crystallized oxygen that your body needs to be healthy, and it's pH balanced, and it's also structurally restored. And what does that mean? Well, basically, the water is relaxed. Water itself is very cohesive in nature. It likes to bond to all the other water molecules through a partial hydrogen bonding. And so what the doctor's done is he's infused energy into the water to basically help repel those attractions and enhance it, relaxes the water. So that being relaxed, it's able to hydrate you faster than any other water out there can hydrate you. It can deliver the oxygen to the cells, the minerals that your body needs to be healthy, and increase your energy, as Brooks mentioned, and you know, as well as eliminate all these other toxic chemicals that are being stored in our cells nowadays. Nowadays we're being exposed to so many chemicals. It's just unimaginable. So what this water does through its hydration property, it allows the water to come into the cell very quickly and very rapidly, and basically flush these toxins out. And the benefit behind that is increased cellular communication. So it fine-tunes the body in that regard. And here's Brooks again there.
You know, a lot of people don't really think about water. They go into the fast food or the convenience store, and they just buy a bottle of water, and they spin the top off, and they drink it. What you don't realize is what's in the water. It's not just clear. You know, Evian is just naive spelled backwards. If most bottled water that you open up, you think, well, what preserves this on the shelf? I mean, it's exposed to sunlight. It drives around in a warm truck. It's refrigerated. It's not refrigerated. How do they keep stuff from growing in it? Well, they add chlorine. A lot of people don't think about that, but if you want to prove it to yourself, go ahead, go buy a little bottle of ortho-toluidine. It reacts with chlorine and makes a nice yellow color so that you can tell if there's chlorine in the water or not. Go ahead, go to the store, buy bottled water, go to your water dispenser where they tip the 5-gallon bottle upside down at your place of employment. Pour you a nice clear glass of that, what you think is good drinking water. Drop a couple of drops of ortho-toluidine in there and watch the chlorine. You're just pouring a poison into your body. The difference between this water, Aquarius water, it's only made here in Oregon, and other waters, is this water is treated in such a way that it can hold in suspension, in solution, crystallized oxygen. And you drink the water, that means it goes right into your bloodstream. Now, normally, your blood has to go through the little alveoli in your lungs, and it has to interact with the, I'm sure, nice clean air that you're breathing, and the oxygen jumps onto the hemoglobin of your blood, goes throughout your body, and that's what keeps you alive. The nice thing about the Aquarius water is now you have another way for oxygen to get into your system. The water that you drink, it's pH balanced, it's clean, it has no chemicals in it, it has crystallized oxygen in it, it goes right into your bloodstream, right onto your hemoglobin, and it dissolves in your body and oxygenates your tissues from within. So you get oxygen into your body two ways. Now, my testimony is, a year ago I came to the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference. It was about 180 degrees here. No, actually it was really hot and it was really dry, and you're just naturally reaching for this water. But when I came here, I weighed 252 pounds. Now, here we are 11 months later, I weigh 222 pounds. I don't mean to tell you anything fantastic, but 30 pounds of ugly fat left behind somewhere is really wonderful to me, and it started with this water. Is it a weight loss water? Okay, yeah, maybe it is, because I'm not jumping for that Snickers bar at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I wind down. My tissues are oxygenated, I've got endurance, I feel great, and if I could buy this water where I live in Louisville, Kentucky, I would buy it. I would pay for the shipping to ship it to my house, whatever it takes to get another one of these great factories built somewhere in the U.S. I'm going to let Cody tell you a little bit about their plant in Oregon and how much water they process, and maybe give us some ideas for the future of Aquarius water.
Thank you, Brooks. Well, basically, the water's processed at a facility called Langenberg Research, and Langenberg Research is the research center that's developed the water through the likes of the doctor. It's a 106,000-square-foot building. Right now, we have two lines there. We have a very large line that's being assembled right now to mass-produce this water to get it to in the hands of everybody. And we also have a small line that the current water is being produced on. You know, our goals in the future are obviously to get this into the hands of every human being we can because of the unique properties that it has. And, I mean, the bottle of water is the tip of the iceberg. We have the research and technology to change municipal water systems and get rid of the chlorination in the fluorination of water. And that's our main goal. Our main goal is to restore water worldwide in third world countries and, you know, all over the world so people have clean, pure water. Water is the basis for all biochemical reactions in the body, and you need to have clean water to have a clean body. And that's our goal. Our goal is just to get this water into the hands of everyone. So I'm going to give this back to Brooke, and here he is.
All right. Thank you very much, Cody Long with Aquarius Water. That's the finest water on Earth as far as I'm concerned anywhere. I don't care where you drink it, then. Whatever we can do to get more of these factories built, more of these processes under construction, one of the hardest things to find in the third world country is a clean glass of water. And that's a darn shame when there's technology like this that's available that can create water like this that can help sustain life. That is it for X Squared Radio, and we're coming to you live at the Science, Spirit, and Earth Transformation Conference in Trout Lake, Washington. Next week, we'll be in Weed, California, just north of Mount Shasta, at the Heart of the Awakened with Shalimar Productions. So make your way to there, shalimarproductions.com. Sign up for one of those lectures. If you're within a 3 or 4 hour drive of there, make your way down there. I promise you will not be disappointed. We'll see you next week on X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew saying, peace, Earth Explorers.